In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. Whatever the virtues of the many fields of knowledge, all are steps on the path of omniscience. May these arise in the clear mirror of intellect. Om Manjushri, please accomplish this. Good evening and welcome. Thanks for joining in here. Tonight we go through the slippery slope of trying to describe how things work and see what the early Buddhists came up with in that regard. A retrospect called Abhidharmakas, those who cleave to the Dharma in a way that makes them dear Abhi. So, tonight, my dear colleague Chris will lead us off in that charge and go through the first approximately half of this wonderful presentation by Noah Rokin, and then I'll pick up and we'll open it up after that. Thank you.
Thank you, Derek. Good evening, everyone. So tonight we'll be talking about Abhidharma. Just sort of want to get a feel for the room. What's everyone's experience with Abhidharma? Has anyone not encountered this term before? Or are we all seasoned Abhidharmakas here? Cool. So maybe we could get some answers on this topic of what is the Abhidharma project? Does anyone have any ideas about what the Abhidharma project might be?
It's an alternative to Project 2025 that views the progress of humanity as a positive thing.
Can it be thought of as an effort to sort of structure and systematize things that were referred to in the sutras but weren't done in a sort of structured, I don't know what the word is, ordered way?
Systematic.
Systematic. Thank you. That's the word.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely part and parcels for what the Abhidharmakas were doing. Anyone else?
Basically documenting our experience and of the elements of our experience and how they interrelate.
So how did they determine the elements of our experience?
How did they determine it? I presume from their experience. I don't know, actually. I guess I probably don't really know whether they were taking it from what they had been told or from their direct experience. I always have assumed that some of it was just looking at their direct experience as well and kind of doing the laundry list. Here's the inventory.
So in the last class, Derek took us through the questions of Melinda. And there's a beautiful... That text is just so full of these beautiful metaphors. And one of the metaphors that is used for talking about the Abhidharma project of Nagasena describes the Buddha like if you went out on a boat with someone with like an exceptionally refined palate, and they could take a scoop of ocean water and drink it and tell you where each of the individual droplets, which rivers they came from. Abhidharma is very much about this idea of taking our unified, seemingly unified experience of our minds and our world, which we tend to think of as, you know, this sort of like amorphous blob in which all sorts of activity happens, and breaking it down into smaller and smaller constituent parts. And the reason for doing this is sort of twofold. One is, as Morgan mentioned, an attempt to really systematize the Buddha's teachings. So many suttas and sutras, as we know, and as we read some of last week, and an attempt to really sort of create a cheat sheet, SparkNotes, what's going on in those sutras, and a definitive system to describe the Buddha's teachings. And part of doing that, breaking things down into these individual components called the dharmas, is to show that as things are broken down, things such as the self are nowhere to be found. And we saw this again with Nagasena in the example of the chariot, right? So is it the axle? Is it the seat? Is it the wheels? No chariot to be found anywhere. And that's very much the system of Abhidharma, is breaking things down into pieces. There are some really tremendous lists that have been produced through this process. And I'm going to see if I can share my screen. Am I allowed to do that? Yeah. So here we've got, can everyone see these? Or here, what's sort of this is from an old Rimeshutra class, which I did not take, so I'm really not in any position to comment. But here we are. So Abhidharma classification of reality. So reality, that's the blob, right, that I was talking about earlier. And then reality breaks down into existent things and non-existent things, which is sort of wonderful that non-existent things get their own category. Then we have objects or things, subjects or mind, and their relationships, how subjects engage objects. Then we have uncreated things, created things. Created things further breaks down into form, primary mind, mental factors, and non-associated formations. So here's part one. Or no, this is one scheme. There are different schemes, which is it's interesting that the different schools came up with different schemes. So it wasn't exactly a settled debate as to what the individual components of reality are. But here we have some of the different things that reality might be made of. Again, we've got created or conditioned elements, and then uncreated elements, which in this are three, space, path extinction, and natural extinction. Path extinction being the extinction that occurs at enlightenment, and natural extinction, Derek, please chime in if I'm totally off base on this. Natural extinction being things like a candle getting blown out. And then you have the conditioned elements breaking into matter, mind, mental factors, and non-associative formations. There is so much detail in here, so much detail that is beyond the scope of our discussion tonight. But I just wanted to give a flavor of what these lists look like. This is another scheme, 100 dharmas. This is part one. And here we have part two. So that's sort of what Abhidharma is famous for, are these tremendous lists. And what is interesting about them is that the items on the list are taken to be real things. So it's similar to the project of atomism, breaking things down into their smallest component parts, and those things being broken down being what are ultimately real. But what distinguishes it from the atomism that we're familiar with in the West, for us, atomism is purely a physical process, the physical atom, the building block of the physical world, whereas for the Abhidharmas, that distinction doesn't exist. The building blocks are psychophysical. So you have building blocks of mind and building blocks of matter aggregating together. So the article that we read for this class breaks this down into four major aspects: time, intrinsic nature, causation, and epistemology or perception. So time, just as mind and matter are broken down into atoms, so too is time. The idea is that there are individual moments that are caused by the preceding moment and cause the following moment. This leads to some interesting questions about causation, because if a moment, the idea is that a moment exists and then goes away. And causation is typically thought of as a thing causing a thing in the present causing something in the future. So if the present is eliminated, how can it cause the future? And there are a variety of different strategies that were used to answer this question. The Sarvastivadins are sort of famous for an idea that all time exists, past, present, and future exist at the same time. So events in the past can cause events in the present because the past still exists. It just doesn't exist right now. The Theravadins and the Theravadins were suspicious of this and explain this using a variety of different factors that surround causation. But still, you're going to have a situation in which cause and effect are existing simultaneously. What do people think about that? I mean, how does this square with people's experience of causation?
It's how we perceive it. It's not ontological. It's mental.
Can you say more about that distinction?
Well, if it's ontological, it means that's how things really work and that everything is outside of us. But Buddhism is more and more telling me every day n nothing's really outside of mind. So
Well,
it's.
I think that for the Abhidharmakas, at least some of them, there is an idea of a real world that the senses make contact with.
Right, but their own scheme is sort of pointing away from it. Or at least, how we experience it, because there's nothing that can be experienced outside of mind. So therefore time is also an experience, and less something that you can grasp and say, oh, it's like this table. It's more of a it's a mental event or a series of mental events that between this mental event and that mental event, there's the passage of time.
But what about causation on a material level? Like, what are the causes of a table?
Can I approach this a little differently? One of the things I loved was hearing the idea in this discussion of time about change creating time by changing. Like, in other words, the fact that things cause each other starts to create time. It's a different way of viewing it, which is identical in some ways to what I was reading Ravelli write in Our Modern Physics, in which he's positing that we're now at a point where our perception of change is the foundation for us creating time. In other words, time is a mental construction based on our perception of change. Doesn't say why things cause each other. I'm not answering that question, but I did think it was a fascinating point.
So you have cause and effect through the arrow of time beyond our mental formations. And yeah, they're connected, cause and effect. It's like sequential.
I think the dilemma here is when are they connected, right? So if cause and effect happen at the same time, then how can they be separate, right? If they're simultaneous, then one doesn't happen before the other. But if they're temporally distant from each other, if one cause, at moment one you have cause and moment two you have effect, how do they actually connect? When do they actually connect?
Well,
are we talking here from an at which level are we talking in terms of tenet systems?
Ideally, Abhidharma.
Right, because in other words, not to the Madhyamaka.
Right.
It's impossible.
Yeah, and I think that Madhyamaka, I mean, this is really where Madhyamaka is going to come in, and by pointing at all of these problems, these philosophical dilemmas that the Abhidharmakas, in many ways ingeniously, try to solve.
Well, they talk a lot about contiguousness, right, in various forms, which to me is a way of saying they're correlated. They are perceived as occurring together, or in either next near each other or with, you know.
So can you give an example in the real world of causation?
Myself, if I press the pedal in my car, it stops the car, right? So pressing the pedal.
The brake pedal.
The brake pedal stops the car by a sequence of mechanical steps, right, that are connected to one another.
Go for it, Chris. So what is the cause and the effect, and then do they meet and so forth?
Well, I guess the cause is depressing the brake pedal, right? And then that sets off a whole cascade of, help me out, people, brake calipers, and brake pads, and pavement and tires, which lead to the car stopping, right? So it's kind of a complicated one, but one we probably all relate with.
The original cause... that Jill said of what made her press the brake pedal is gone.
Oh, right. But that's right. Mental. Let's stay with the physical.
Oh, you want to say, okay. So we're only doing physical. Okay.
So is stepping on the brake pedal and the stopping of the car, do they exist at the same time, or is there a difference in time?
Depends how good your brakes are.
Well, we know it's not instant because there's a certain amount of time, and it depends on how fast you're going, whether you're going to bump into the car ahead of you or not when you put the brakes on. So it's a variable length of time, but and as Chris said, there's a number of steps that go on.
But think about braking. You can break time down, like just keep breaking it down, like what's an instant, and they aren't connected. Or, I mean, they're not occurring at the same time. If they occur at the same time, you wouldn't have time, right?
But in the final scenario, the breaking of the pad makes the brake pads or the calipers that control the brake pads compress around the tire, and they hold the tire from moving. So the car stops when that happens, and you could say that's the cause of stopping is the brake pads hitting the wheels, the tires. So aren't those at the same time?
Well, I think due to friction, there's a little period of time that it takes to, I don't know if it's instantaneous, but.
Wouldn't they say there is a real moment where that's sort of a shared moment between the brake pad being compressed and the car stopping? There is an actual
That the cause and the effect exist at the same time that they meet.
There's sort of a brief moment where they meet and then it moves on.
So isn't that true in this example that you press the brakes, that compresses the brake calipers, and that moves the pads to hit the tire, and then the tire gradually stops? So that's pretty simple, right? Straightforward. Are there other examples?
From our perspective, it's happening at the same time.
How about lighting a match?
Yeah. Off.
What happens? You take a stick that has flint on the end and you rub it against some other flint or something. I guess they both have flint, right? And the friction causes a spark that lights the flint on the stick. So isn't that simultaneous cause and result?
So at time one, you've got flint, not lit. At time two, you've got the contact. Time three, you've got a spark. Time four, you've got ignition. And at time five, you've got a nice flame on the end of your match, right?
But like, is there a moment where an unlit match and lit match sort of exist at the same moment? That's the question.
Yeah. Exactly.
There was at the end of this article, there was a statement about object fields, right? That there exist maybe not just pure objects, but fields that are these objects. And maybe those fields are meeting, which might be, anyway.
Well, what exactly does an object field mean?
In my understanding of the text, I thought it meant are multiple perceptions related to the object,
mm-hmm.
right? So the wood, the stick, the, you know, the whole, the realm, I don't know how to describe it in other words exactly, but that the stick is not just the stick, the piece of wood,
mm-hmm.
right? That it has elements that we also associate with it. So, and not just cognitively, physically as well.
Right. I mean, there's like the oxygen that makes the combustion available and the rest of the stick that the flame can consume. Yeah, there's all, you know, there's a million other factors. And yet, I also think of the Abhidharma project as a method of trying to reduce all the factors so that we can understand what's actually going on.
But everything conspires to light the match.
Sure.
I think even if you wanted to go with the simpler approach, you know, not worrying about the air conditions and all that.
But what Emily was talking about with a match being lit and unlit at the same time sounds suspiciously like Schrödinger's cat.
Well, I think if you look at the steps that Chris laid out, you know, so there's the friction and then the spark and then the ignition and then the flame. So you really can't say, is there an unlit and a lit match at the same time? You'd have to look at each of those steps is a cause and effect in itself.
How can you differentiate the spark and the flame?
Size, maybe. If you want to call the spark a flame, then we could eliminate one step, but still we have.
I think it's the spark is the flinty stuff sparking, and then the flame is the wood itself is now like burning.
But that's the flame moving from the flint to the wood.
Okay.
Sure. Okay, but it's a different fuel source, right? So you've got the flint is fuel source one causing the burning of the wood, which is fuel source two.
Right, and you could transfer that to paper or any other thing, right? But
right.
I don't think that's crucial for the causality we're looking at. The friction of the flint against the flint, the match box. I mean, you could do it without flint on a match. You could do like primitive level and have like a stick and you're rubbing the stick and that heat produces.
Right, but let's just say whatever it is, it's friction, creates heat.
Yeah.
Creates spark, becomes bigger flame. Okay, I mean, whatever number of steps you want to add in there. I think the question that it boils down to, though, is between each of those steps, there is a transformation going on. And so each one of those is a causal, could be thought of as a causal event. So when we're looking at the question of are cause and effect connected, I think we have to look at each of those little steps.
Yeah, break down one of those little steps.
Rather than trying to go from the unlit to the lit, you have to say, okay, friction is the spark, like if the friction is the cause of the spark, are they simultaneous or not?
If you stop the friction, then the spark doesn't happen.
And it has to be like a critical mass of friction, right? Friction has to, you can't just like tap the match, you have to strike the match.
It just seems to me that you people are prejudiced and you're trying very hard to prove that the cause and the effect are not meeting.
No, I'm just trying to.
Which common sense says they meet, right?
Yeah, there's a point of contact. And is there time in that point
how could,
of contact?
But if they meet.
The lint and the match not light if they didn't meet? How could they light if they didn't meet?
Lint and the match. We're not saying that they didn't meet. We're saying that one thing scrapes against another. And we're calling that friction. Okay.
One thing leads to another, and the presence of one thing leads to the presence of another thing.
You know, I'm okay with them meeting. What I'm not okay with is calling each of them, like giving each of them like some sense of reality. That's what I don't like about it.
That's the key, right? It's like we have this idea of, okay, there's a match that's unlit, and then it becomes a lit match. As if those are like different things.
Are you saying that they're the same?
They're similar in that they're both not things.
Okay, sure.
Right. But the Abhidharmakas again are realists about form.
Right. Like
There's a thing there.
Yeah, there sure is. There's a match, and there's flint, and then the match catches on fire. Yeah.
There's a quote in the reading. I think this is a Theravadan approach that says, "As one event is exhausted, it conditions a new event of its kind that proceeds immediately afterwards. The result is an uninterrupted flowing continuum of causally connected momentary events. These succeed each other so fast that we conceive of the phenomena they constitute as temporally extended." I just thought that was interesting because it's saying, as one event is exhausted, it conditions a new event of its kind that proceeds immediately afterwards. So it's like, that's where it gets
tricky, isn't it? Because of its kind, and then at some point it becomes of a different kind, right?
But, yeah, I mean, a lot of what this is talking about is, you know, we're talking about a thing that undergoes a dramatic change, an unlit match becomes a lit match. But a lot of what they're trying to explain is how a thing that doesn't appear to change, if time is momentary and sliced into these impossibly thin slices, you know, how does this pencil continue to persist? So their explanation is that pencil at time one causes a similar pencil at time two, and so on down the line.
And don't they meet?
That is going to be an interesting question that I'm not sure they satisfactorily resolve. Because
they assume that there has to be a cause, that meeting is a requirement of causal efficacy.
So the question is then, when do they meet? Right?
Is what there, does meeting
is,
mean?
Is there a gap between time one and time two where both of these pencils are meeting, and pencil one conditions the existence of pencil two that then exists in moment two?
Yeah, they occupy the same space. How can two objects occupy the same space? So how can you say that an object disappears? Where did it go? When you talk about momentary impermanence, where do things go in that gap?
Yeah, but there's no object without a mind perceiving it. So it's just, it's
that's not true. In Abhidharma, there's objects regardless of minds.
Is that the way they see
you have
it?
You have to accept that their point of view about the world's framework, you know?
I thought that they were saying there were dharmas, which is a mental, mental experience. Like,
why do they call them matter? Why do they call them matter if they're mental? They have
there are mental dharmas and form dharmas.
And matter dharmas. You're saying those don't matter? What about this thing about the three times existent? What do you make of that? Do you just like dismiss that as absurd?
Well, I mean, it's not entirely out of line with the way many contemporary physicists think about time existing all at once, and we just have a particular vantage point.
I'm curious. There's a tendency that we all have to like refer to modern physicists as if they lend authenticity. Do we need to do that?
Maybe not, but it is.
Could we stick within their own system? Like, what are they solving by saying that the three times exists?
Well, I think they're solving this problem of how moment one can possibly cause moment two without them being simultaneous. If moment one isn't, you know, obliterated into the past, from which it can have no causal efficacy, then it can cause moment two without any problem.
But so, how can we say that it's in? Well, what's the point of talking about the past in that context anyway? Because then it wouldn't. I mean, it seems like we're redefining what that means.
I don't understand you. Like in the case of perception, where perception arises in a sequence of events, and we perceive something in the past, and so. Either you say that perception is invalid and imaginary, or you're perceiving the past. And so the past continues to have efficacy. How does karma happen if the past is not still existent? So there's a difference between, we tend to think existent means present. They think existent means efficacious. Mm-hmm. This is a big difference, I think, right? So how else can karma happen if the past is not still existence? And how can we impact the future if the future is not existent? How can we impact it by things we do now? It's a very different way of thinking about reality.
The Sautrantikas are going to have an interesting response to at least the first part of that question about how can the past influence the future.
Let's go there.
Present. And for them, the idea, the causation carries seeds into the future that can condition the behavior of future events. So things like memory, things like karma. Create these seeds that can persist and then cause something in the future.
I love that. So phenomena deposit seeds, and those seeds impact the future. Can we talk that through? Does anybody think that makes sense? Anybody want to take that position and argue that position? Chris, why don't you take that position? So tell me,
Sure.
what do the seeds look like?
The seeds are, I mean, it's so hard to not just immediately go into how Yogacara interprets this as existing in the Aliyavijnana.
Okay, let's go there. So the seeds
Okay.
are what, little eggs or little.
Yeah, little karmic tendencies that lie latent in the storehouse consciousness,
And
the Aliyavijnana.
what produces them?
What produces them? Events in the past or events in the present, right now. Right now, I'm
Events are things.
activity of karma.
Events are
If
things. They weren't on that chart. I didn't see events on those charts.
Now we're back in the mind.
It just boggles my mind that they come up with seeds. It's like it just complicates things dramatically. You have a dharma, let's say, fire, and fire has seeds. Or let's say
Yeah, I mean
you have anger,
it's like
anger. Let's say
they're
moment
tying
of
up.
anger. Anger deposits seeds. What do the seeds look like? Where do they live in Aliyavijnana? Like, so where is that? How do they get called up? It's just like it duplicates every phenomena in a hugely complicated way. Every phenomena has how many seeds?
Is
But the Abhidharmakas are not averse to
logical.
complication.
God.
Is
Warrior,
it
tell me
is
about the
it
seeds.
well, I just is it possible that there's a third sort of
Leg.
substance? There's form, which we think of as matter, and there's mind or consciousness or whatever you want to call it, awareness. There's also energy. At least from our perspective, they don't seem to mention that.
Oh, let's look at the list again. And energy, can you give an example of energy?
So energy is conserved, like in the braking example, the energy exerted by your foot causes the pedal to move, which
Oh,
causes other things to.
we missed that entirely, right? It's like, what is it that's actually transferred from your foot to the pedal, to the cables?
Because if you think of the seeds as energy being persisted somehow through time, they don't look like anything. They don't have a form. They aren't matter.
Kind of like you could also call it potential. So you have this potential or energy, and you call that potential gets called up like karma.
Yeah, so energy, does energy have specific laws?
Specific?
Laws. Does it
Yes.
operate in a predictable way?
Yes.
Does karma?
Does karma? Karma? No, aren't we supposed to?
Karma is famous for being unpredictable.
Right, I was going to say,
There's
isn't the thing about
karma
karma?
that some karma matures immediately, some matures later. Some karma has big impact, small
Right.
effect. Sometimes the impact and the effect are the same, and sometimes the cause is small and the impact is large.
Yeah, because isn't the instruction that you're supposed to believe in karma and understand that to be sort of fundamental to how things happen, but not understand it? Isn't that one of the things that an enlightened mind can't understand? Is the workings of karma?
I love the way you phrase it, that we're supposed to believe in it but not understand it, which
Yeah.
this is like totally different than everything else in Buddhism, that we're like only supposed to understand and not have beliefs, right?
Well, I mean, the one of the
Yes.
isn't one of the grave transgressions to deny the workings of karma?
You're spot on. You're spot on. It's just the way you phrase it maybe is a little bit is very well done. It's not
Okay.
usually said that sort of abruptly, maybe. It's a hidden phenomena, right? There's evident
Yeah.
phenomena, and then there's phenomena we can deduce by inference, and karma is said to be extremely hidden. In inference is hidden phenomena, and karma is extremely And it's like said that only a Buddha can really understand the workings of karma.
But so given all that, trying to figure out how any of this explains karma seems like a fool's errand.
But we're not talking about a fool's errand. Well,
But we can't understand how karma works. So whatever notion of cause and effect we're going to come up with in, say, an Abhidhamma context is not going to explain karma
that's
by
an interesting
definition.
thing. The all of the schools acknowledge that they can't understand the intricacies of the karma of a specific event and its ramification into the future, but they all try to understand how does the karma work in a general sense? How does it function? Where, basically the absence of a self presents on one level a conundrum for karma.
But if you
Who does
understand
karma
the what we
adhere
think
to?
of as a, oh, sorry, go ahead. I was to say, if we understand that what we think of as a sort of solid or slightly somewhat unchanging self is not really that, but is a perpetually shifting. Sorry, the noises are always there. That's part of the ever-changing city environment. But in the sense that ourselves are a constantly changing, being reconditioned, and so the Alaya Vijñāna, for example, if we're using that as the model for where these habitual tendencies sort of reside and get mixed up and stirred up and cause the next thing to happen and the next thing to happen and all that sort of thing, then it's really a constantly changing process. It's not like the seeds are planted there and just sit there for, 100 years or something. There's kind of a flux of what's going on, right?
It would have to be because the theory of momentariness would apply to them too. So the seeds have to constantly be re-sowing themselves.
Exactly. So it's not like, when we think of store, seeds and storehouse consciousness, you kind of think like an inventory. A bunch of shelves full of seeds or something, but it's more like, obviously, first of all, it's not tangible, as Morgan pointed out before. There is no physical existence to these things, but it's more of a, but it, it but there is this sort of constant stirring up and changing of it. At least, I don't know, I've been maybe reading too much of the Profound Inner Topics, but that's the way they describe it there.
Yeah. So we have seeds, but they don't germinate until you give it water and soil. And so you can't stop karma, cause and effect, but you can feed it. And maybe that's my view. And the way they were getting at it was don't feed the karma. You
Use
can.
a Roundup.
Yeah, there you go, Roundup.
Kill those seeds, the bad ones. Why don't we both go back to Chris and go back to this issue of how do we get from impermanence to momentariness? And this thing about like the three phases of origination, endurance, and cessation, and some of them have decay, one system had decay. Are
Yeah,
those
so the Theravada system has this what they call a moment. And that moment has three parts, arising, enduring, and perishing. And that's said to be a single moment. And again, we have an interesting question of how one moment can have these three parts, right? So are those three sub moments? And again, the point of contact of like, is there a sub moment between the arising and the enduring? And looking at all of this, while the Theravada may seem more sensible than the Sarvastivada, a system in which all time exists at once, it does seem like it brings up a lot of conundrums that the Sarvastivadins avoid.
Yeah, so on I made our ability to reference the pagination of the document difficult because I circulated a version that had different pagination than the one in the source book. But if it's okay, I'd like to refer to the one in the source book.
Please.
And so on page 19, the Theravada used the term kana as the expression for brief instant. So the first full paragraph there, right? The
Sorry, Derek,
dimension.
what's the source book page number?
Oh, that's a
I
good
got it.
question.
It's page 70. Thank
Teamwork. Thank you. Thank you, Debbie. Yeah, I had a
And for those who are
rollover from
looking at the
last book.
other thing, can you give like headers or something?
It's in the part three from imperm time from impermanence to momentariness.
Bottom of page 13.
All right. So the Theravada used the term kana. Everyone there? Cynthia's still looking. Bottom of page 70, I think you said, on the
Go
source
ahead, I'm
book.
okay. Don't stop for me. I've got it.
The dimension, a brief instant, the dimension is not fixed. Meaning that it's not like we've heard other examples where a moment is like a 60th or a 360th of a finger snap or something, as if like it has a fixed duration that can't be reduced further, right? So, for example, citta kana refers to one instant taken by one mental event in the basic sense. In this basic sense, is denoting a very brief stretch of time. The term moment does not entail an atomistic conception of a definite and ultimate smallest unit of time, but leaves open the possibility that time is infinitely divisible. Here, the three moments of origination, endurance, and cessation do not correspond to three different entities. So, in case it wasn't clear in the description before that, the other traditions were viewing those words as having a referent that origination, endurance, and cessation were entities. So you have a moment of Chris's pencil, and it has three entities. Things are getting very complicated. The pencil has color, it has texture, it has a smell and taste, and it has origination, endurance, and cessation. So, yeah, the Theravadins simplify that. They represent three phases of a single momentary phenomenon, divided as one single moment, in this case, consciousness. In this way, they avoid some of the clunkiness or difficulties of the Sarvastivada by Bhāṣika of how to compress the characteristics of the condition into one single indivisible moment, which is, the author, she explains this earlier, that the Sarvastivada by Bhāṣika have these three aspects of a moment happening at the same time, which is a little bit funky, that the origination, the subsistence, and the dissolution are happening at the same time. Because otherwise they would be three
Why even talk about them in that case? Doesn't that, like, what would they mean in that case?
Yeah, well, they mean that they're trying to explain that things appear and dissolve.
I mean, it doesn't make sense to say there's still those three things, but they're all at once. You might as well just say it's just
Well,
like.
how does the origination of a pencil in one moment produce the subsistence of the pencil in the next moment? So there would be the pencil subsistence would be caused by the origination, the pencil's origination, and then it would be destroyed by the pencil's destruction, as if those are three different entities.
So the question is, how do you get from the destruction of a pencil to the next, the origination of the next pencil?
Yeah.
Well, or about a bardo. Let's go with a bardo. That's the way we do it in our human lives, right?
In between any of those phases of pencilness, origination pencil, subsistence pencil, and then dissolution pencil. What is causing the origination to stop?
And if the origination can stop and start, is it sensible to talk about it as being one instant and not two instances or three instances? The arising of the arising, the enduring of the arising, and the cessation of the arising, right? And then we could, you know.
Well, I mean, in a way, all the way down. Even the notion of origination not continuing forever, you know, it's a little bit like the idea that, you know, something can cause something endlessly. You know, if origination is truly origination, it would only originate, right?
So it must have
somehow built in some kind of dissolutionary. I mean, again, I don't understand any of this stuff.
Yeah. So is there some other dharma that enters in and moves it from one phase to the next? Or are they pre-programmed? You know, so I think, at least what I'm trying to understand or get at, is that it seems to me that what we just went through is not a non-obvious problem, right? These people were thinking this through, and they must have realized that it had these problems, their system. But it seems like at some certain point they would let things be clunky, so to speak. You know, and so it sort of, I think, turns us back to the sort of overarching idea of the course of, like, what is the view? And to what extent do you need to create a description of things that is perfect in order to realize the view?
Ronkin has some interesting things to say about this very question in the last section about epistemology.
Yeah, let's go there.
And she talks about how the Abhidharma movement comes at a time in Indian thought where people were sort of moving away from metaphysical questions of ontology about things that really exist and how they exist and so forth, and moving more towards questions of epistemology, how things are perceived, how they exist in our mind. It does seem like the Abhidharmists have kind of a foot in either camp. They're interested in perception, but they're still firmly committed to the idea of a real world out there that is perceived. But yeah, as Derek says, there's a certain tolerance for the clunkiness of the system insofar as it can help explain what it is we're experiencing.
There's a certain part that I would love for you to talk through and then for us to discuss. And I apologize, Chris and I had an agreement. I'm like totally going against what we decided we were going to do, but I think this is more fun if we just like talk about it.
We're playing jazz.
Definitely. Talk us through, and here we go with the pagination problem. It's page 31 of the original document, and this paragraph starts with restricting the account to the consciousness process of ordinary beings. I should get into the source book and find the source book page.
Source book page appears to be 76.
When you say original document, that's different than the recent one that you disseminated?
That's right.
So can you again give a header to get us into the right area?
Yes, we're in the last section, which is epistemology, and it's 3 pages in from that, so it's 4 paragraphs in.
Cynthia, it's the top of page 22.
I'm just in the there. Looking.
This feels very fitting for the Abhidharma, that there's like 3 different pagination systems that we're trying to.
It's like restricting the account, that page 20.
Yes, restricting the account. I found this fascinating. Chris, would you mind, even though this was my part, would you walk us through this?
I can do my best, but I will be honest with you, this totally went over my head.
Okay. Maybe I'll go through it.
Yeah, maybe you can, I'll pitch this back to you.
Okay, so restricting, and how about if I screenshot, share the specimen, so we don't have to worry about pages, ideally. So here we are, restricting the account. So we're in the section on perception, right? Restricting the account to the consciousness process of folks like us, ordinary beings. 2 types of processes are described. The 5 sense-store processes, presumably meaning sense perception through the 5 senses, and mind-door processes, presumably meaning the activity of the 6th consciousness. And so you see this, the implication of the use of the term mind here is the 6th consciousness, right? Whereas often mind has 6 varieties, but here this author is basically saying, and picking up the terminology in the source document. So mind or processes, these may occur in succession, or mind or processes may occur independently, right? So succession meaning you can have a sense perception. You light the match and you see the light, and then that, and then you think about it. Eye sense door processes account for sensory perception as information is directly received from the fields of the 5 sense faculties. Sorry, 5 sense door, not eye.
Sorry, Derek. Sorry, can I just ask for a clarification on mind or processes occurring independently? Would that be thinking of a match being lit without having actually seen one?
Thank you. Totally.
That is okay.
Right. So these may occur in succession, meaning you have the sense perception and then you think about it, or you may think about the weather just as an idea in your mind. 5 sense-store processes account for sensory perception as information is directly received from the fields of the 5 sense faculties. Mind-door processes internalize the information received through the sense faculties and characterize the mind that is absorbed in thought or memory. So, mind-door processes internalize the information. So there's information that's transferred from the sense doors to the mind door in this scenario, which is the first of these two types of scenarios, which is sequential, right? Succession. Objects at the door of the mind, knocking on the door of the mind, which is treated in Buddhist thought as the 6th sense faculty, may be past, present, or future, purely conceptual, or even transcendent. What would be a transcendent object? What's a conceptual object, by the way? Objects at the door of the mind may be either past, present. A present object would be the match in front of your eyes, right? The past object would be, let's say the match goes out and you're thinking, why did the match go out? Future object could be the match that I'm going to light next. Is that fair? What is a conceptual object?
Is that like world peace?
World peace. I love that. That's my favorite example. Thank you. World peace is a conceptual object. Definitely. What's a transcendent object?
Nirvana?
Nirvana. Yeah, we're in the Abhidharma world where they don't have emptiness, shunyata, which otherwise would be the more common transcendent object, right? Normally, however, the object of the mind will be either a past memory or a concept. What's the difference between a past memory and a concept in terms of the mind or? So I think that descriptions of how the mind works is really the most interesting. Matter is complicated, but the mind, working in the mind, I think is really fascinating, trying to piece that together. So I'm sorry, Chris, you were about to say, what is a past memory?
So the difference between a memory and a concept is a concept is if I ask you what's the capital of New York versus a memory is tell me about your trip to Albany.
Yeah, right. So tell me about your trip to Albany and I would bring up, let's say, a memory of the visual experience of the capital of Albany.
Yeah, it's like there's a who, what, where with memory, whereas, at least I think it's in the way they mean it, whereas a concept is more factual and doesn't have that, you know, locational aspect to it.
But if I say, think about the capital of New York State, would that be a concept or a memory?
It depends how you think about it,
right?
Have you
been there? It's a concept.
And it depends. Yeah, it depends if you've been there.
Because
if you've been there, you've
Jill,
experienced
help me
it
out.
Personally.
Well, I was going to bring up the idea of the particular characteristics versus general characteristics, where memory relies more on things that have particular characteristics that you have experienced. Whereas a concept doesn't always have that particular characterization, if that makes sense.
Oh, wow.
And now that's not true.
Let's segue to that and can anyone find that in the text so we can look at that? Where was that? Because this is, oh, it's forward. So this is a sort of key distinction in later schemes of descriptions of experience. So it's here on page 76 of the, 78, sorry, of the source book. And it's on screen here. So the author is saying that within Buddhist circles, I love that phrase, it gives rise to these guys. And the Abhidharma sets the stage for the epistemological bent that they turn, that they take around those circles. And this new emphasis becomes dominant from the period of the Vaibhasha compendium, the conclusion of that, onward, and is evident in the shift in the terminology used by the Abhidharma, which is, when the author says, in the terminology used by the Abhidharma, is the Abhidharma a who, what, where, or is the Abhidharma a concept?
I'm going to take a stab and say concepts.
I think so. I think so. The Abhidharma. So generalizing the Abhidharma individuals, oriented individuals or authors, to be the Abhidharma, to describe the nature of dharmas. The shift is indicated by the terms particular, inherent, characteristic, in Sanskrit, swalakshana, and general, samanya lakshana. Lakshana, the term lakshana means a mark or a specific characteristic that distinguishes an indicated object from others. We saw earlier in the description of swabhava, or intrinsic nature, that natures are distinguished by their characteristics, right? And the explanation is the logicians use this term in the sense of a definition of a concept or a logical category. And this specific characteristic distinguishes an indicated object from others. And that distinguishing characteristic is used in the sense of like defining one, say, dharma or sets of dharmas from others. Coming and in this sense, where she says use the term in the sense of definition of a concept or logical category, which of these two types is she immediately referring to, particular or general, when we say concept or logical category?
That would be general?
I believe that would be the general. So if you generalized like the definition of an apple or a match, and you come up with a concept of the category of things that are apples by using a logic of descriptions of this and that. Abhidharma applies it to the practice of the discernment of dharmas, distinguishing between multiple generic characteristics the dharma shares with other dharmas and at least one particular inherent characteristic that defines the dharma as that very individual occurrence distinct from any other instances of its type. Now that's like the best description that she gives of this term, but it's not an easy sentence to unpack. Chris, did you what does this mean to you? Abhidharma applies it to the practice of the discernment. So distinguishing between multiple general characteristics of a dharma. What would be multiple general? Like pick a dharma, and then what would be some multiple general characteristics?
How about a table that has table at the top?
Okay, what are some generic characteristics that this dharma shares with other dharmas?
It's made of form.
It's a form. It's matter, right? It's matter in terms of like what skanda, we might say it is. What else? So there's many other dharmas that are matter, so it shares that with them. Anything, any other general characteristics?
It has a certain size, generally. We could characterize the size of tables as, you know,
yeah.
Philosophers like the term medium-sized dry good.
That's great. Yeah. And there's many phenomena that have the size of whatever table you're referring to. And many of them are not tables. There's many things that are not tables that share that size, right? So that would be a shared general characteristic. Let's say it's a 3 foot long by 2 foot wide. There's many dharmas. Any other characteristics that table may share?
Well, there's the, you know, having legs and having a top is fairly common to the notion of table.
Tables. It shares that with other tables. Anything else?
Function. Tables are used
it in supports, particular way. Right. There's many things that have that function, many of which are not tables, right? People, you can put things on top of people. they can support things.
eat
You
or
could put it
dinner.
on your dog. Your dog, you can use as it's, to support things. You can use water. You can put things on water, like things that float, but those are not tables, but they support, they're supportive, right? Any other characteristics that tables have that many other dharmas have? There's some big ones. Like, what are some big ones that most dharmas have?
It exists.
It exists, meaning that it was produced, right? It's produced, right? It's impermanent.
It's conditioned.
It's conditioned. Many other dharmas have that, right? That's a common fe that's a feature common to almost all dharmas, right? Are there any dharmas that don't have that?
There's a small number that don't have
A
that.
very small elite number of dharmas that don't that are not produced and conditioned and impermanent, namely
It is
nirvana.
designated as such conceptually.
Many dharmas have that. That table can be generally conceptually designated as blah blah blah, right? Okay, so what is at least one particular characteristic that defines a dharma as a very individual occurrence distinct from many other instances of its type? Going back to Chris, what would be a one particular inherent characteristic of the table?
Of a table or tables generally?
So that's a good question. Can tables generally have a unique inherent characteristic?
I don't really think so.
No. So then it would mean
It would mean an individual table.
an individual table, yeah.
So, I mean, one would be spatiotemporal location. This
Right.
table is located in this place at this time, and nothing else is there.
Bingo. Right? So that makes it a specifically particular inherent characteristic is the table that's in front of me right now. Right? So
I
that's
was a
that.
bit. Oh, sorry.
Go ahead.
I just the word inherent in that one, I was a little confused by these saying particular inherent characteristic.
Yeah, so that it's like it's inherent to the object. It's not some like
Right,
additional
okay.
add-on type thing, okay, so
Yeah.
there are those types of categories, and we were talking about perception.
Can I
Yeah.
Follow up
Yeah, keep
having
that
looked
line going,
at
Jill.
because what you had asked about the difference between a memory and a concept,
Yeah.
and what I was we I suppose we could have a concept of a table in our of a particular table in our mind, like a table I know and that I've experienced, but I still think I'm labeling that a memory, so like the table that I experienced in my dining room, I'm not there right now, but I have a memory of it versus that concept of table, which is not specific. So I'm saying all memories, this is what I'm trying to say, memories have that inherent, that particular characteristic of having been experienced directly.
But you could turn your memory into a concept by imagining it in another way.
It's a fine line.
Is it still a memory then?
No, then it becomes a concept. Like you remember your table in the living room, it's brown, and then you imagine it red.
Well, how about this? We just talked about this scheme of a particular inherent characteristic and general characteristic. Is that scheme a general inherent characteristic, or is it a specific inherent characteristic? Is that scheme,
The scheme is.
The scheme itself is general. Us talking about it is specific.
Yeah, so it's a concept, right? That scheme is a concept. So do you remember when we were talking about it a few seconds ago?
Yes, but I think the discussion is a sensory experience that I'm remembering, and that had a particular characteristic.
So,
but I think the word had is important there, because it had, your dining room table had a, has a specific characteristic when it's in front of you, but then when you're just remembering it the next day, it's conceptual at that point.
So let's walk right through sense perception. Does anybody have an object they can show us that we can get visual? Okay. So does everybody see what Mary Beth is holding up? Okay, so she's holding up. It looked blue and rectangular and thin to me. Anyone? Now it's no longer blue. It's red on the back and it's black on the on one side, but it's rectangular and very thin, right? Okay, so within this scheme, we're having a sense store cognitive event called visual consciousness, right? Where there is a physical object that has shape and color, or maybe even more technically, there's color and shape, and light is reflecting off it into our computer camera and then being projected by our computer camera onto our screens. And the light from our screens of that color and shape are then projected into our eyes. And the eyes transmit somehow that into a visual consciousness where we're conscious of that color and shape. How am I doing? Is that reasonable?
Except that it also was right there at the door of our mind, because I went from there to it's a phone based on my memory.
I mean, I can't help you with your problems there.
You're a step ahead of where he is. He's got it to a visual consciousness, so it's the shape, color has penetrated to our mind, and then we move into calling it something and saying, I like these, I don't like these, and all that stuff, right?
There's also the step where at first it's projected upside down, the image, and then your brain flips it. That's a part of it too.
That's a very interesting idea that you've read in books. Or maybe you've seen a little movie about it, as if the image is a thing. So, Chris.
There's also the fact that Mary Beth has been very diligently showing us all the sides of this object. Mm-hmm. So the form, the sense experience of it is constantly changing. And it's only in our minds that we think of it as a discrete, unchanging object.
Oh, we've added that, right? So what is, in terms of those categories of specific individual inherent characteristic and general inherent characteristic, are your eyeballs general inherent characteristics, or are they specific, whatever she says, individual, particular? Are those particulars? Or are they general, your eyeballs?
My eyeballs are particular.
Right. Our eyeballs are particular, as are Mary Beth's and everybody else here, pretty much generally.
Generally or particularly?
Particularly. And so we have a particular object that's registered in a particular sense faculty. And I've glossed over the difference between the faculty and the eyeballs, right? Just for simplicity. And then we have the consciousness. What is that consciousness? Is visual consciousness a particular inherent characteristic or a general characteristic?
An instance of visual consciousness is particular.
Does everyone agree with Chris?
Yes.
Visual consciousness as a category is general.
Okay, good. So visual consciousness is a particular inherent characteristic, where it's a phenomena that is characterized in a particularly, in an inherently particular manner, let's say. And that visual consciousness, can it be located? I see one shaking head. I see half a shaking head.
Where do you stand on, I don't know how to say this even, because when my visual consciousness in my experience is kind of like,
I'm actually talking about Abhidharmas. You know, within the Abhidharma world, is consciousness, does it have a location?
It certainly has a location in time.
Yeah. I was going to say time too.
Well, location is spatial. I don't know if you can use the word location in time, like a duration. It has a duration. But consciousness is non-material, right? And so it doesn't have a location. And that visual consciousness of the color and shape, which changes every moment, so we're having a succession of slightly different. Is a consciousness and is non-physical. So then when we say that you have a thought, now let's, keep the phone out of our visual field, and let's remember what color did the front of that object have? One surface of that object, anyone?
Well, it changed from blue to black, depending on whether it was on or off.
Okay, so that process that Cynthia just went through, that cognitive process, can someone describe that? That consciousness, that's the sixth consciousness. And the sixth consciousness is experiencing the idea of.
Well, I was going to say there's a mental image. That was what I was trying to, that where I am drawing on a mental image or that, and I think they have a term for it. I don't remember what it was in the text for the representation.
Yeah,
did everyone in consciousness this? Of the object, like the, and I'm not sure what that right. The aspect. I'm
the
not
aspect.
Sure what the term
they
is.
Call it the aspect. Yeah. So the sense door apparatus generates an aspect in consciousness, and then that aspect is what the author called the information that's transferred to the sixth consciousness.
But that changes depending on which school we're talking about, right? So like for the Sarvastivada, we're actually seeing the world. Whereas for the South Tantrikas, we're seeing a representation in our minds that is caused by the interaction with our eyes.
Yeah. So let's start with the Sarvastivada that believe that the eye sense faculty actually extends out and connects directly with the sense object, right? So when that is transferred to the mind sense, what type of an object is that?
Color.
Well, the eye's consciousness sees color, but what does the mind consciousness experience?
A mental object.
A mental object. And it's that mental object is not the physical object that was physically contacted with the visual sense faculty and the Vaibhashikateravada sense, right? And a mind object is, what sort of an object? Is it a specific, particular inherent characteristic or a general?
Once the self-talk and the explanation jumps on it, it becomes a general.
But before that, specific. The first moment would be specific, right?
Yeah, there's one specific moment. That's and moments are very quick, right? So when we then think about the object, the color that was experienced with our visual, and then talk about it, what is the object of our mental consciousness at that point? We would call it a memory, right?
Right. At the point that we're saying, like, it went from this color to that color, that's would seem to be memory.
General.
And then getting into the reason why it's changing and all that, that's getting into...
We're remembering the color. Mm-hmm. And what is color? Is color a general characteristic or a particular inherent characteristic?
Well, it can be both, right?
Do when, phenomena have color?
When you're experiencing
how it's light.
So color is a concept added onto light, right? The perception of light to say, oh, there's red, there's black or blue. Those are concepts.
But then, in terms of what you said
say
before,
the opposite.
Emily, isn't that... this is what you've read in a book too, right? How that works?
The labels are concepts, but the experiences are particular.
Right, but we've gone from the visual consciousness sees blue, and the mental consciousness has a one very quick moment of that light, let's say, and then the mental consciousness recognizes it as blue. So it's said that when the mind does that and calls it blue, that's concept. Right?
Right. The label
is everyone okay with that?
The label is concept, but the experience isn't.
Right. And so when we label it blue, are we doing that based on memory of other things that we've attached that label to, of other types of light?
It's not even a memory. It's just a categorization. So when you take the phone away, like you said, there's that instant, you still see the phone. But once you start describing it, I don't see any phone. I'm just taking your description and I don't see blue. I don't see black. It's conceptual. But there was an instant when it wasn't, but it turns into that.
So is there any difference between memory and concept?
Most memories are concepts, right? Or memories of a concept. I think that makes them conceptual.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it wasn't covered in this article, but in other places we've encountered this. But it's interesting to like struggle with and think about that, right?
I mean, they're not identical categories. They're not complete overlap, I don't think.
So when you ride a bicycle, right, you That's memory. That's memory at work.
That's a leap. Yeah, yeah, but it is.
It's memory at work. It's muscle memory. And the balancing and all of that. Those are all memories, and it's not conceptual. It's very visceral.
Okay, so let's come back to this guy now.
But you're on the bike. What happens clarifying. When you're thinking about riding the bike?
Yeah, but I'm saying when you're riding, I'm thinking of, the thoughts that are happening when you're riding the bike are conceptual. But the riding itself, with the knowing how to do it, how to steer, all that. It's based on memory, but it's not conceptual. You're doing.
Okay. I remember now how complicated this is. So can you guys see the shared text? No, I did not see. I didn't remember how to share. Here, there we go. Now you see it, right? So we were here. Objects of the mind door, which is treated as the sixth sense, may be passed. Present, future, purely conceptual, even transcendent. Normally, however, the object of the mind door will be either a past memory or a concept, unless you're thinking about the future, I guess. If there's no perceptual activity, as in the case of deep, dreamless sleep, the mind is in a state of rest called inactive mode, bhavanga. Throughout one's life, the same type of citta performs this function of the inactive mind that is the natural mode to which the mind reverts. So, what is the mind then? This author has just distinguished the mind basically as separate from the sixth sense faculty, that this mind is in a state of rest. So when the mind then is in a state of rest, and then it changes into the mind experiencing objects, is that the same mind? What is this mind? Throughout one's life, the same type of citta performs this function. So citta means, is translated as mind, performs the function of the inactive mind that is the natural mode to which the mind reverts. The mind switches from its inactive mode to a simple mind or process when a concept or memory occurs and no attention is directed to the other five sense fields. The simplest mind or process is a succession of the following functions. The mind adverts to the object of thought, a function that lasts one moment and becomes internalized as an object support. So the mind is adverting, like it turns into the sense consciousness.
So can I ask a question here? In this level that we're at in this system, it's related to this question of where they're getting this separate mind thing going on, because isn't this one of the levels where consciousness is viewed to be a momentary event?
It is, yeah. So the mind of the sense consciousness disappears, and then you have the mind that's inactive or thinking, right? So it's momentary. But it's confusing the way the language is here in terms of describing the mind.
So basically it's not one of the consciousnesses that's behave. I mean, this implies that there's something beyond the six consciousnesses.
It does. That is called the mind, and that sort of connects with the consciousnesses, including the six consciousness, on a momentary, moment by moment basis.
It almost right. So like, is that consistent with this actual school that there, I mean, the, are, or are they kind of stretching it here a bit?
Chris.
I can't speak to how consistent this is with Theravada.
We'll see it in a couple of classes, or one class, next class, we'll see a couple of articles that talk about this process. Sorry, Chris.
It does feel like it's describing attention.
Yes. Yeah, like basically attention goes from one place to another. And is that attention... Who moves the attention?
What do you mean, who? You were talking about an agent?
Or what? I mean, how does the attention decide to go from here to there, from one door to another?
I
What makes it go from one to another? I'm just trying to like throw out there this idea that on the one hand, it's like they come up with a really cool description of experience. And on the other hand, it just like proliferates the number of quandaries and problems every time you describe it.
Well, I mean, one thing is that from this, it sort of shows you where all the later developments of
Exactly,
the
yeah.
consciousnesses came from, because, you know, it's like it's hard to limit yourself to the momentary consciousness thing, right? And so you can see they're sort of slipping ahead almost into different tenet systems, right?
Yeah.
And on the other hand, you also see how this gives birth to Madhyamaka of people
Totally,
throwing up
just
their
the
hands and saying this is completely inconsistent and incomprehensible, and not only is it that way because of the way it's designed, but the whole project is doomed to failure. You couldn't build one that worked because these contradictions are built into the system itself.
So the key question comes back to like realizing the view. It's like, what is the point? Does this have a utility, this system? And does the Madhyamaka method have a have a utility that also goes to the same sort of place of like letting go of the fixation that causes suffering, basically, right?
I think going back to what we were talking about at the beginning of class, that Abhidharma is a real powerful means by which the, seemingly unified sensation of the self and of the world can be broken down into component pieces and demonstrate that those things don't exist. And that's a very fundamental Buddhist technique that is useful. There's a reason that Nagasena employed Abhidharma techniques and terminology when talking to Melinda. And there's a reason why the Abhidharma is preserved to this day and still studied.
Well said, Emily.
This is a continuation of what you were just saying, Chris. I also find for myself, no matter which of these systems I think about a lot or read or go through the logics, I eventually sort of hit up against this gap-like experience. And while I know we're not dealing with emptiness in these systems, it does feel like no matter how you parse this all down, you eventually hit a wall with it. And it kind of causes me to take hit this blank space that it feels very experiential and I find to be very helpful, even if it's a system I ultimately don't agree with or it's been just, sort of taken apart by later system.
The interesting thing is that the later systems, I think pretty much by and large, have the point of view that the more detail that you try to describe things in using the frameworks of the lower systems, the greater the possibility of the sort of letting go into emptiness that one can produce if
The
produced
paradox
as
is that the
a
paradoxes are a virtue, not a bug.
Yes. It's like showing the paradox in multiple different ways and like trying to eliminate the paradox and just like not being able to. But like where we were, we don't have time now, but I urge you to read this again. This is just a fascinating explanation of how perception comes about.
In a way, I suppose this approach, these at every level, is a little bit like, our version of the Zen koan.
Yeah, exactly.
There's a
That's
dreamlike
great.
quality when you bump into the wood, like Emily was saying, you run into emptiness with it. There's a dreamlike quality when the paradoxes come up. Make the whole thing surreal.
Yeah.
I do think it's important, though, to reflect that there is some explanatory power to this material, that it's not just about creating paradoxes, but that understanding the five skandhas is useful for understanding the mind. It may not be written into the structure of the universe, but it is a useful way of unpacking our experience that's helpful on the meditation cushion.
Yeah, there's definitely useful
Bingo.
Tool.
Well said.
I think it's just when you try to take it to the ultimate perfect sort of system, that's where it always fails, right? That you can never fully explain.
And I think that may be in part the demands that Madhyamaka asks us to perform. That the Abhidharmas didn't feel the need for this ontologically pristine system, that, you know, a certain level of explanatory power was enough.
That is so well said. It's sort of like, if you don't get it with Abhidharma, you know, if you're that thick, then you need a subsequent school, as opposed to like thinking that the Abhidharmas are so thick and, you know, that's Madhyamaka. It's almost the other way around. It's like for them, it like did it. You know, they have numerous arhats in their tradition. But.
Right. But I mean, earlier you were saying that these guys must have understood some of the weaknesses of their own explanation.
Yeah, and realized there were weaknesses and just
use
the system up to the point of letting go of the system.
Right, it's that it may be that, I mean, obviously the more that the logical mind tries to fix and grasp and get the ultimate explanation, the less likely you are to have that, you know, realization and arhatship and all that stuff happening. So whether it's because of their faith or whatever other reasons that they could actually find realization, it wasn't just through this logical process necessarily.
Yeah. Okay. Well, sorry, last comment.
Last comment. I think it's really interesting also to think of it as a method of producing language to talk about ineffable experiences, because I think they were really using categorical language to try to reach something that can't be said.
You know, you muted yourself towards the end. I wasn't sure if that was intentional way of like emphasizing your point, but anyway, why don't we conclude at this point with close with our dedication of merit. By this merit, may all attain omniscience, may it defeat the enemy wrongdoing from the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness and death, from the ocean of samsara, may I free all beings. By the confidence of the golden sun of the great east, may the lotus garden of the Rigdon's wisdom bloom, may the dark ignorance of sentient beings be dispelled, may all beings enjoy profound, brilliant glory. Thank you, Chris, and thank you, everyone.
Thank you, Derek.
I hope this was helpful and enjoyable. Have a good evening and take care. Bye.
Thanks.